The U.S. national debt crossed $40 trillion, and the phrase analysts are using, silent default, deserves explanation because it's not the same as the kind of default that makes front pages. A traditional default is when a government misses a debt payment. What analysts mean by silent default is something more subtle. The Federal Reserve monetizes debt by purchasing treasury securities, which expands the money supply, which causes inflation, which erodes the real value of what the government owes. Creditors get paid back nominally but receive dollars worth significantly less than what they lent. The debt is defaulted on in purchasing power terms without any missed payment.
The 40 trillion number needs context because it's large enough to be almost incomprehensible. The U.S. GDP is approximately $30 trillion, which means the debt-to-GDP ratio is now comfortably above 130%. Japan has been operating at debt-to-GDP ratios above 200% for years without a crisis, so there's no automatic trigger point. But Japan also has a domestic savings rate and a home currency-denominated debt structure that gives it more resilience. The U.S. situation is different in composition.
What concerns serious fiscal economists isn't the number itself, it's the trajectory and the interest expense. At current rates, the U.S. government is spending somewhere in the range of $800 to $900 billion annually just on interest payments. That's approaching the size of the entire defense budget, and it's spending that produces no services, no infrastructure, no defense capability. It's purely the cost of past borrowing.
The political conversation around this is almost entirely performative. Both parties have contributed to the debt trajectory. Neither has a credible plan to reverse it, and the constituencies that would bear the cost of genuine fiscal consolidation, seniors, defense contractors, healthcare providers, are politically powerful enough to block it. The 40 trillion headline is significant. But the more honest story is that the political system has essentially decided, without explicitly saying so, that it will not address this through revenue or spending adjustments.
Which connects actually to the Shane IPO story, because what Shane is doing in Hong Kong this week illustrates something about where capital markets are positioning globally. Shane is targeting a $25 billion valuation for its Hong Kong listing, down from a peak paper valuation of $98 billion in 2022. That's a 66% haircut on peak value, and Shane failed listing attempts in both New York and London before pivoting to Hong Kong.
The New York and London failures were partly regulatory. Shane faced intense scrutiny over its supply chain practices, labor conditions, and its use of the de minimis trade exemption that allowed it to ship packages under $800 directly from China to American consumers without paying duties. Congress moved to close that loophole, which materially changed Shane's cost structure in its largest market. Going public in that environment was not viable.
Hong Kong as an IPO venue is an interesting choice strategically. It gives Shane access to Asian institutional capital and sovereign wealth funds in the region. But it also signals something about Shane's assessment of its own geographic future. The company is betting that its next growth phase is more Asia-centric and less dependent on the U.S. consumer, who is increasingly paying attention to where and how fast fashion is produced.
This is actually a good moment to step back and explain something that comes up a lot when we discuss companies like Shane and their regulatory battles. Because the antitrust and competition law framework matters for understanding why these companies face the scrutiny they do.
Go ahead, Sarah.
So when people hear that a company is being investigated for antitrust violations, or when regulators raise market power concerns, there's often confusion about what that actually means legally. The foundation in the United States is the Sherman Act of 1890. It's the original federal competition law, and it does two core things. Section 1 prohibits agreements between companies that unreasonably restrain trade, think price-fixing cartels. Section 2 prohibits monopolization, which is where it gets more nuanced. Here's the part that surprises a lot of people. Having a large market share is not illegal. You can be the dominant company in your industry without violating the Sherman Act. What the law prohibits is acquiring or maintaining monopoly power through exclusionary or anti-competitive conduct. Meaning, you used your size specifically to crush competition in ways that harm consumers or competitors beyond just being more efficient or making better products. A company that's dominant because it genuinely offers better products at lower prices is, in the eyes of the law, doing exactly what competition is supposed to produce. The legal threshold for monopoly power is typically set around 70% market share in a defined market, but defined market is itself contested. A company might have 90% of the market for a narrowly defined product and face no antitrust concern if there are adequate substitutes. The government has to prove both that the market power exists and that it was obtained or maintained through conduct that goes beyond legitimate competition. That's why big tech antitrust cases are so complicated. The definitions of the relevant markets and whether conduct like bundling or preferential self-placement crosses the legal line are genuinely contested questions that courts have been wrestling with for years.
And that framework is directly relevant to what happened with Shein in the US regulatory environment. The de minimis loophole wasn't technically an antitrust issue, but the competitive distortion it created prompted exactly the kind of regulatory response that companies with controversial market practices should anticipate. When your business model depends on a regulatory arbitrage, the arbitrage is eventually closed.